The system I mentioned about memorizing scripture has continued on to this very day. The Orthodox Jewish community in Jerusalem are very heavily subsidized by the government, and basically these are people who spend their entire lives doing nothing but studying scripture and memorizing scripture. These are the ones in the black coats, the black pants, black shirt, well, white shirts, black hats, side curls, and all of this. So, they're heavily subsidized by the government. Most of them don't have jobs. So they will, spend 10, 12, 15 hours a day doing nothing but memorizing scripture and debating scripture and so on. And it's kind of a continuation of this same culture with Jewish schoolboys and girls. The boys memorized the five books of Moses. The girls had their own sets of books, which were, don't remember off the top of my head. I know there was Deuteronomy and I think Proverbs and Psalms, if I remember correctly, that the girls were expected to memorize. Those would be books that would be more appropriate for their roles as wives and mothers in that culture. So a lot of things that we see starting and reflected there in the gospel still continue on to this day and have shaped the world. So now we'll pick it up with another very, very key topic to help us understand what's going on in the Gospels, and that is the political background of the Gospels. Before we actually get into the Gospels, we need to understand some of the backgrounds that will help us understand what we're reading about. In other words, with the Gospels, we're kind of coming in the middle of a movie. And who are the characters? What's the subplot? What's the context? What's going on in the background? So to understand some of the events around Jesus Christ and his life and ministry, we do need to understand the political and religious background of the Gospels. So that's what we'll focus on in the remainder of today's time. If we need to understand the Gospels, we need to understand the background of what is going on and the context of the times and the events and the location there. So let's first talk about the political world of Judea and Galilee, which is part of the Roman Empire. I want to start with a passage back in Galatians, which you've already covered here in epistles, which says, Galatians 4, verses 4 and 5, "But when the fullness of the time had come, God sent forth his Son, born of a woman, born under the law, to redeem those who were under the law, that we might receive the adoption as sons." Now, what does this mean when it mentions here the fullness of the time had come? This is a phrase I'm going to talk about here. Obviously, it's talking about the time for the Messiah to come, the 70 weeks prophecy, Daniel, which foretold the year the Messiah would appear. Okay, when we get into the Gospels, we see that people are expecting a Messiah to appear around that time. Why was that? Well, because of the 70 weeks prophecy of Daniel, which foretold when the Messiah would appear. So we see this expectation that this prophecy is going to be fulfilled. But I want to take a look at it from another angle as well. And that angle is the influence and the power of the Roman Empire that actually allowed the gospel to be spread and for the church to be founded when and where it was founded. This is very important for us to understand because here's a map of course, the Mediterranean Sea here and the Roman Empire. The Romans called the Mediterranean don't remember the Latin phrase, Mare Nostrum. They called it our sea because the Roman Empire totally surrounded the Mediterranean Sea, all around here. So the area we're focusing in on is the Holy Land over here at the eastern end of the Mediterranean Sea. But again, going back to Galatians, Paul says, when the fullness of the time had come, what did he mean? Let's consider that God is a God of master timing, and he does everything perfectly in his timetable and according to events. For example, let's just consider what would have happened had Jesus been born in this area 100 years earlier or 100 years after. Well, 100 years earlier, before Jesus Christ's birth, the Mediterranean Sea was infested with pirates. The Roman Empire had not reached its peak yet. The Greek Empire had declined. And there were all these cities, ports around the Mediterranean that were whoever had the most men under their command, the most ships, the most arms, ran that part of the Mediterranean Sea. So there were a lot of pirates. Julius Caesar, for instance, when he was a young man, teens or early 20s, I don't remember the exact time frame. This is before he became Caesar, but he was actually kidnapped by pirates in the Mediterranean. And they kidnapped him and held him for ransom. And Julius Caesar was kind of the Donald Trump of his day. He was a larger-than-life figure, very brash, very, very boastful. He told the pirates, look, the ransom you're saying you'll take for me is too low. You need to raise it because I'm more important than that. So eventually his family or whoever it was did pay the ransom and they released him. But he said, for what you have done to me, kidnapping me, I will come back and I'm going to kill every one of you. So he went back. Became emperor, raised a navy, and did exactly what he said he would do. Came back to that port and killed every one of the pirates and established a Roman navy that ruled over the Mediterranean and eliminated the piracy problem. So had Jesus been born 100 years earlier when this area is infested with pirates, what would that have mean for spreading the gospel? Very, very difficult, because how does Paul travel much of the time that we read about in the book of Acts? He's traveling by ship. He's traveling on cargo ships. Commerce is safe and common in the Mediterranean. Paul travels on these cargo ships that sail all along the coast, along Asia Minor, over to Greece, back here to Jaffa, Haifa, there in Israel. So that was because the Roman Empire came in and cleaned out the pirates. What if Jesus, so it would have been very difficult for the gospel to spread in this time period had Jesus been born 100 years earlier? What about if Jesus were born a century later right around 100 BC? Well, around that time, there is a second Jewish war that is brewing. There was the revolt 67 to 70, then later there's the Bar Kokhba rebellion. For the first few decades of the second century there, the early 100s, there's a revolt and a war that is devastating to Judaism around there because of the unrest and rebellion against the Roman Empire. So there is actually just a window there in that first century when it was safe, you might say, for Christians, for Christianity to spread, for the gospel to spread. How many of you have heard this term, Pax Romana? Pax Romana. Okay, memorize this term because it will be on a test, if not mine, certainly Mr. McNeely's. Pax Romana, what does it mean? It means peace of Rome. Peace of Rome. Pax is peace, Romana of Rome. And what this means is that the Roman Empire enforced a level of peace and security and stability that had never existed before in that area to that extent. To understand the alternative, you might consider, you're all fairly young, but what has happened on the world scene in the last 8 to 10 years as the United States has withdrawn from its overseas commitments? Well, there was a term that became pretty popular about 10, 12, 15 years ago, Pax Americana, the peace of America, meaning American military might kept a lid on all the unrest going on, not all, but most of the unrest going on in the world. This was after the Iraq War, and the United States intervened after the United States drove Iraq out of Kuwait, for instance, back in the early 90s and so on. A fairly common term a decade or so ago was Pax Americana, because the American military had established a level of peace and stability throughout the world and kept a lid on things like North Korea, like Iran. Now, because of a very different philosophical approach of the American government for a better part of a decade, where we withdrew from our overseas commitments and backed down and didn't show strong force, now we've got Iran pursuing nuclear weapons with our help, and you've got North Korea launching missiles like it did just yesterday toward Japan and threatening the United States with hydrogen bombs and stuff like that. Because the United States is withdrawn from its role as world policeman, now the bad guys, the nut jobs are taking over. And it was very similar, very, very similar parallel with the Roman Empire. When the Roman Empire was strong, there was peace and stability and security there, enforced by the Roman military. And this was, so without somebody in charge to maintain peace and order, it's basically every man for himself. And that is what had been the pattern in the Middle East for centuries before that and for centuries since then. This Pax Americana was so well known and highly regarded, they've actually discovered a monument, an altar, it's called, to peace, that stood in the ancient city of Rome. It's called the Monument of Augustan Peace, under Caesar Augustus, the emperor when Jesus was born. And this is a reconstruction. They haven't found all of it, but these are the parts that they have found. And it has different panels up here representing peace. I want to give you a close-up of one of the panels. As it, again, we see all these Roman and Greek monuments that are white marble and limestone. They were actually painted in that time in realistic colors. So it's just that the paints are gone over the last 2,000 years. But here's what this panel looked like. And here's a figure in the middle who is thought to represent the goddess of peace. Her name was Pax, P-A-X. And she's got these two babies. They're playing on her lap. There's flowers beside her. There's a cow and a sheep grazing peacefully at her feet. There's another goddess over here sitting on a swan, symbolizing that all, even the birds are at peace. And over here is a goddess sitting on a sea monster, showing that even the seas are at peace under the Pax Romana. So this was this is commemorating the peace that Caesar Augustus had instituted as the first emperor of the Roman Empire after the death of Julius Caesar, and how the world was now at peace under the might and the glory and the grandeur of Rome, which of course was enforced by the Roman legions around the world. So while the Roman Empire had many failings, its later emperors were very corrupt, insane, and in some cases individuals, a huge benefit that it brought to the world at that time was the Pax Romana, the peace that it established. Brutal at times, though it was. But we do see this as a theme again and again in the Gospels and later in the book of Acts, where the Roman Empire, if you kept your nose clean, if you didn't cause any problems, if you paid your taxes, the Romans pretty much left you alone and would allow a certain level of self-government and autonomy and freedom of religious worship. That's how Christianity was allowed to flourish in the Roman Empire at that time. It wasn't, you could not start a new religion because that could upset the peace. But Christianity was viewed initially as simply an outgrowth of Judaism. So it was a licit religion, a legal religion, as opposed to an illicit or new religion, which was not authorized. So again, that just is a sidelight that shows the similarity. As far as the Romans were concerned, they couldn't tell any difference in early Christianity between the Christians and the Jews, because they all worshipped on the same day, the Sabbath. They all kept the same holy days, Passover, Pentecost, Days of Unleavened Bread, Feast of Tabernacles, and so on. They all ate the same. They didn't eat unclean meats and so on. So the Romans didn't see Christianity as being any different from Judaism. So it was okay. It was allowed to exist as a religion, whereas you could not, under Roman law, start a new religion. So this allowed Christianity to exist and to begin and to spread in that particular window of time. You might also consider that in the Gospels and the book of Acts and Paul's writings, we find repeated references to robbers and thieves there. For instance, the parable of the Good Samaritan, where this man is traveling the main highway between Jericho and Jerusalem, and he gets set upon by a group of robbers who beat him up and leave him for dead by the side of the road. And the Good Samaritan takes him under his wing, takes him to an inn, and pays for his medical care for him to be treated. When Jesus is crucified, he's crucified between two people on either side. Well, how are they described? Robbers. One of the problems, one of the troubles that Paul says that he was threatened by, shipwrecks and beatings and floggings and in peril from robbers. So robbers are a pretty consistent theme that pops up again and again in the early New Testament period there. And that is even while this is an occupied area occupied by the Roman Empire, Roman armies. So imagine how bad it would be were the Romans not there. It would have been very unsafe to travel. It would have been very unsafe for Jesus and the 12 to travel around. Not the 12. Most of the times it's probably a group of at least 15 or 20. And frankly, this is probably one reason why they are traveling in a fairly large group, is to protect themselves from robbers. But that's kind of beside the point. But Paul is rarely ever traveling by himself. He nearly always has a traveling companion or two or three or four with him there. For safety reasons. So there are robbers, and the Pax Romana helped create a level of peace and stability there so the gospel could spread. Some other factors that the Roman Empire attributed or contributed to in terms of spreading the gospel. Today we have our interstate highway system, like the one just down the hill here. Where did we get that idea? We got it from the Romans, because the Romans established a major road system throughout their empire. When the interstate highway system was first developed and funded back in the 1950s or 60s, the original title of the spending bill included the fact that the interstate highway system was being created to allow the U.S. military to quickly transfer military forces from one part of the country to the other. That was actually an idea that came from Germany during World War II. They had their first interstate highway system there, the Autobahn. We were copying that idea from the Romans. The Romans created a vast network of roads, which you can still see in places today. This is from the city of Ephesus, and you can see the ruts from the carts on the stone highway. This is the main road through the city of Ephesus, and you can still, 2,000 years later, still see the ruts worn by the wagon wheels traveling the main streets there. Here's another Roman road leading out of the city of Hierapolis in modern-day Turkey. City of Hierapolis is mentioned in the Epistle to the Colossians there. So there's this vast network of Roman roads. And when Jesus and the disciples are traveling, and when Paul is traveling and the other apostles, what are they traveling on? They're traveling on this nice system of Roman roads that the Romans have instituted, and by which this time it's relatively safe to travel on. Another factor that ties in with the pirates that I mentioned earlier is cleaning out the pirates made it safe for shipping and travel by ship, passenger ship, cargo ships. Here's a mosaic of a cargo ship of that time. And this is how Paul is traveling from city and port and so on around the Mediterranean, traveling by these by these cargo ships, grain ships, carrying different goods back and forth through the Mediterranean. So transportation was revolutionized in that period under Roman peace. Again, before this time, the sea was filled with pirates, so it was very dangerous to travel. You literally took your life into your own hands to do that. And by the way, be sure and take notes on these too. Yeah, the Pax Romana, the peace that was established, the road system, the travel by ship here as well. These are very important. Another factor was the Roman mail system. We don't know much at all about it, but we do know from Paul's writings that Paul could reliably send letters to individuals and church congregations far away. For instance, he's writing letters from Asia Minor to send over to Greece, and writing letters from Greece to send to Asia Minor, and writing letters from Greece to be taken to the church in Rome, and things like that. So there is a reliable mail system of a sort. We don't know how it worked much about it, but Paul could reliably use that. And because of that, what do we have? We have most of the books of the New Testament that were these letters that were passed around. So there's two factors. There's the road system. There's the transportation by ship. There's the mail system. And a fourth way that the Pax Romana helped the gospel to spread was by the universality of the Greek language, kind of like English is today. Today you can go just about anywhere in the world and find people who speak English. I've traveled to Turkey, to Egypt, to Jordan, to Israel, to Greece, to Germany, to Italy, to Switzerland, to Britain, to Scotland. And the English and the Scots speak a form of English, but you can still understand them if you try really hard. So, come on, wake up. That's supposed to be funny here. So Greek was kind of the equivalent of that day. You could go anywhere and people would understand Greek. You could find Greek speakers. So that is why we have the New Testament books preserved for us in Greek and the Gospels preserved for us in Greek. So four major factors there. Actually, five if you include just the overall peace, but those are significant ways in which the fullness of the time had come. As Paul put it there in Galatians, conditions were right for the Messiah to appear and for the church to be able to start and to spread and get off the ground. Otherwise, likely would not have gone anywhere had that happened a century earlier or a century later. There was just that window of time there in which conditions were right for this to happen. Greek, the Romans just really were enamored with Greek culture. The Greek Empire was not very long-lived, and it actually descended into civil war after the death of Alexander the Great, and the Romans were kind of able just to step right in and take it over. But they were really enamored with Greek culture. That's why they adopted the Greek gods and just renamed them. Zeus became Jupiter. Athena became Minerva, I believe it is, and so on. So anyway, you probably memorized a number of the Greek gods and goddesses and Roman names for them back in grade school. Do they still do that anymore? I know when I was in grade school, you had to memorize the various Greek gods and the Roman equivalents and so on. That was part of schooling when I was growing up. So the Romans were actually quite tolerant toward other religions. When they conquered an area, if the religion were not a direct threat to Rome, you could practice your religion. So Judaism was tolerated for the most part. There were conflicts, but for the most part, it was an uneasy truce, you might say, there between Judaism and Christianity. The Romans actually incorporated a lot of religious practices from other religions. This is why, Christmas is coming up. Where did Christmas come from? Well, there was the Roman practice or festival of Saturnalia in late December. There was the birth of the sun god on December 25th. A lot of that actually traces back to Babylon and Egypt many centuries earlier. The Romans adopted those religious practices, merged them with their own, and eventually that morphed into what is Christmas today. To give an illustration of how the Romans adopted culture and religions from other cultures, here's one of my favorite photos ever. This is in the Vatican Museum in Rome. How many of you are familiar with the Egyptian god Anubis or Anubis? Okay, quite a few of you. The jackal-headed god. Here is the Egyptian god Anubis, and he's dressed in a perfect Roman toga like this. So the Roman, this is from the villa of one of the Roman emperors who was particularly enamored with Egyptian culture. So you got Anubis here, complete with the sun disk, the solar disk between his ears, very typical of the Egyptian gods. And he's wearing this perfect Roman toga with a staff on it here. And in this particular emperor's villa outside of Rome, he was so enamored with Egyptian culture that he created a scale model of Egypt in his villa of the Nile River with the pyramids and temples and things like that. So he had all kinds of statues reflecting Egyptian deities and so on in his villa. So this kind of captures that mindset. I guess to the Romans, Egypt was kind of like Las Vegas. It's where you go to party and have a good time and all of that. So they just were really one Egyptian nobleman, one in Roman a nobleman, even built as his funerary monument in Rome a pyramid. And if you go through Rome, you can see it. It's about 50 feet high. It is one impressive tomb, and it's a direct copy of the Egyptian pyramids there. This is again important to helping us understand how Christianity would have been accepted initially by the Roman Empire. And of course, that ultimately led to the transformation of Christianity as it merged with all of these pagan Roman beliefs and in Catholicism and so on, as we understand. There were two Roman emperors who reigned during the lifetime of Jesus Christ. The first is Augustus, or Caesar Augustus, from 27 BC to AD 14. He's also known as Octavian or Octavius, other names. That was his given name. He was the great nephew and heir and adopted son of the famous Julius Caesar. He was not a direct son. He was an adopted son. So he was the ruler from 27 BC through AD 14. He is the one who called for the census or registration that we read about in Luke, when Joseph and Mary go to Bethlehem to be registered. That was for taxation purposes. He is more or less viewed as the father of or the originator of the Roman Empire. He was a great administrator. He was a good emperor, very capable administrator, a fairly wise ruler. He wasn't a tyrant like later emperors like Nero or Caligula, some of those. One thing that he did that affected this part of the world was an idea he actually picked up from Alexander the Great, because Greek culture was very heavy in the Middle East and the area of the Gospels as well, Israel, because of Alexander the Great. And Alexander had a policy when he conquered areas, as soldiers reached the end of their enlistment period, in the Greek army, and again, the Romans picked up and copied this idea when their enlistment was up and they retired from the army. Their service was up, generally about a 20-year term or something like that for the Romans. The Romans would give them a cash buyout, a pension, a lump sum in a lot of cases. They would give them some land, maybe 100 acres of land to set up a farm or build a house as an estate for them, and the soldiers would retire in whatever area they happen to be in. So this is how a lot of the cities that we find mentioned in the Gospels and in the Book of Acts were founded. Is first by the soldiers of Alexander when the Greek Empire ruled over that area. That's why you have a lot of cities named Alexandria. There wasn't just the big Alexandria in Egypt. There were a number of cities called Alexandria throughout the Greek Empire. Antioch, the same thing. There's a famous Antioch. It's mentioned in the book of Acts after Antiochus. But there are actually a dozen or more cities named Antioch of various sizes. Same thing. So these soldiers would muster out of the army, and in the case of officers, same type of thing. So a lot of these would become the founding citizens of these cities. So that worked great for the Greeks and for the Romans because you had these men with military training who could help organize the defenses of the city. They had administrative training, so they could become the engineers, the mayors, the consuls, the diplomats, the architects, this kind of thing, the builders of the city. So you had a good core of people with very valuable skills for founding and establishing and running and administering these various cities. So this is the origin of a lot of the major cities of the ancient world of that time period in the Greek and then the Roman Empire. So this played a huge role in the stability and the organization of the Greek Empire first, and then the Roman Empire. So this is why you see this also this very heavy Greek and Roman culture that Paul in particular encounters as you read about in the book of Acts, and to a lesser degree there in the Gospels as well. So this is why this culture is so strong in that part of the world, even though the underlying culture in the Holy Land, at least, is Jewish or pagan, depending on the area. Then we come to the second emperor who is mentioned, and this is Tiberius, who reigned from A.D. 14 to A.D. 37. Augustus was a very long-lived emperor. He was, I think he was close to 70 when he died. I don't have it in my notes here. So as a result of this, Tiberius, his successor, was already an old man when he became emperor. Augustus became emperor when he was in his 20s. Tiberius was in his 50s and was kind of a grouchy old man, frankly, during his reign as emperor. So he is the one who is reigning when Jesus is executed, is crucified. Below the Roman emperors was another level of rulers in the Holy Land called the Herodians, after Herod the Great. This is thought to be a statue of him. He reigned from 37 B.C. to 3 or 4 B.C., not exactly sure of his death. But he's the one who is reigning over Judea and Jerusalem when Jesus is born. And, of course, he's the one who orders the slaughter of the baby boys. Herod is an egomaniac. He's a very paranoid person. He is known as the great builder because he's the one who builds the Jerusalem temple and many other fabulous structures, transformed Jerusalem into a world-class city at that time. He's famous for being a great builder, but also a very paranoid man who could be deadly if you crossed him. He was 22 years old when he began to rule. He was actually educated in Rome, spent a lot of time in Rome, so he copied a lot of Roman culture, architectural styles into his building projects. Let's see, I'm going to skip over some of this about Herod. again, he was paranoid. When the wise men come after seeing the star and come and say they've come seeking the king of the Jews, Herod goes into full-blown paranoia mode and orders the murder of the baby boys because he is the king of the Jews. And if there's another king of the Jews, he wants to know about it and he wants to make sure that king is eliminated. So he's not a threat to his reign. So he was a very paranoid individual. There's a lot of intrigue going on behind the scenes during his reign. Josephus talks about Herod a great deal. You might want to read some of that background. It's quite a remarkable story. He is actually an Edomian or Edomite by birth. This is the area down here. To orient us, here's the Dead Sea. Jerusalem is right here. Idumea is down in this area. It gets its name from the Edomites in the Old Testament period. So this is what Herod is. In the first century BC, the Edomites were forcibly converted to Judaism. So this is how Herod's family ends up reigning and ruling there. He's a his ancestors were forcible converts to Judaism. So he's kind of Jewish in name only, somewhat in practice, although that's debated whether he's more pagan or more Jewish in his outlook. But he did build the temple for which the Jews gave him a lot of credit. The Jews did not like him. He was pretty detested. One reason for that is he turned the high priesthood into a paid position. I actually continued it because this practice had been done earlier. Here's a depiction of the high priest. Herod used this as a means. He basically sold the office of the high priest to the highest bidder. And that's another story we'll get into in more detail later. It was supposed to be a hereditary position based on descent from Aaron, the brother of Moses. But in the 100s BC, the Jewish leadership started selling the position to the highest bidder. The Romans continued that under the Roman governors and so on, and Herod the Great. So Herod, being paranoid, murdered three of his own sons because he thought they were conspiring to overthrow him, to replace him as king. He had multiple wives and mistresses. His favorite wife, Mariamne, a variation of the Jewish name Miriam, had her murdered because he thought she was conspiring against him. So a lot of, again, a very paranoid, very, very angry man. To give an illustration of his thinking, as he was nearing death, he ordered that 100 or more leading citizens be rounded up and locked inside a theater or stadium. And when he died, he left orders that those men were to be killed so that there would be mourning in the land when he died. He knew the people wouldn't mourn for him, so he was going to see that they were mourning because he would murder the local leadership, or left orders. Fortunately, cooler heads prevailed, and that did not happen, but it shows the mentality of this man as he neared death. Again, he was a great builder, built the temple complex there in Jerusalem, transformed Jerusalem into a world-class city. Here's another view of the city and the Temple Mount complex, which you can visit today, and the temple on top of it. Some of the huge structures and buildings around the temple. This is a Roman fortress over there. All of this has been destroyed today down to the foundations, but really quite remarkable. Here is a scale model of his palace in Jerusalem. This is apparently later, after Herod has been dead for decades. This is apparently where Jesus is tried, where he's brought before Pontius Pilate, the Roman governor, in Jerusalem. Here again is the temple back here in the background. This is the upper level of the city, the wealthier portion there. He built the port of Caesarea Maritima, named after Caesar, Maritima, meaning it's on the Mediterranean coast. Built this fabulous port city from scratch, which drastically helped the economy of the country. Here's what it looks like today. This is where the city was. Here was a hippodrome for horse and chariot racing. Here's a theater. Here's the governor's residence there. This is apparently where the Apostle Paul was kept in prison for a couple of years there at Caesarea. And this is the port. This used to have a breakwater that extended on around there, which you can see in some aerial photos. So he built this entire city from scratch. Named it in honor of Caesar. Here's another reconstructed view of his palace there at Caesarea Maritima. He also built various other cities as well. He rebuilt the ancient Israelite capital of Samaria and renamed it Sebaste. You can go and visit that area today. This is part of the entrance road with the columns beside it going there. He built a fabulous palace down at Jericho, down in the Jordan Valley. These are remains excavated from around that. And of course, probably one of his most famous constructions was the Fortress Palace of Masada, overlooking the Dead Sea. If you ever go on a tour of Israel, they'll probably take you to Masada. And this was part of his palace there. He had a three-level palace out here. Give you some idea of the scale of this. This is a huge ship-shaped plateau, about a 1,000-foot climb here. And, of course, this was the last holdout of the Jews in the Jewish rebellion of the 67 to 70 AD war. This was the last place to fall. But this was Herod's palace. Fabulous views. Here's the Dead Sea out in the background and modern-day Jordan over on the other side. Here's a close-up of those levels of the palace, the beautiful views there. Just really, really an amazing site to visit architecturally. Another one of his famous constructions, this is near Bethlehem. This is called the Herodium. It's another one of his palaces. Herod, being paranoid, built palaces, a number of palaces in Israel and Jordan, what is today Jordan, where within a few hours from anywhere in the country, he could flee to the safety of one of these palaces because he's always afraid somebody's trying to kill him, which may well have been the case considering his nature. This is a Herodium. Basically what Herod did is there were two mountains, hills beside each other. He moved one mountain to another one. Does it remind you of a saying from the Gospels? If anyone who has faith, he can say to this mountain, be moved. When Jesus said that in Jerusalem, his disciples can look south and they can see where a man moved a mountain, referring to this palace of Herodium. Herod took a hilltop, literally. The original hill is about half this height. It looks like a volcano if you go there today, so you can recognize it. But he moved a mountain that was about half this height, put it on top of another mountain, and then built this fortress palace inside that mountain. And this is about 8 or 10 stories high above that mountain. Now, this has all been torn down since then, but this is called the Herodium. And this was one of Herod's more famous palaces, just a few miles outside of Bethlehem today. So let's see, trying to see what else I need to cover here. After Herod died, his empire, this is one of the maps you have at the back. I think this is the back page. It's just shown in color here. His empire was broken up among his different sons who are mentioned in the Gospels, like Philip, who founded the city of Caesarea Philippi up here, naming it after himself and Caesar, his patron. This area of Judea and Samaria, one of his sons originally inherited it. He was such an incompetent ruler, he got removed, and the Romans installed a Roman governor there. So that's why we see the governor Pilate and then later Felix and Festus in the book of Acts, who are reigning over this part of the empire. Then Herod Antipas, another of his sons, reigns over this area around the Sea of Galilee, as well as Perea down here. So his headquarters is up here at Tiberias, named after the emperor Tiberius, and so on. So this is why you have these different regions that are mentioned in the Gospels, that Christ is traveling back and forth through at different times. I really need to get into this so we can get into the Gospels tomorrow. So I'm going to skip ahead here. Most of them are just mentioned in passing, if at all, in the Gospels, so we can cover that. I want to talk very quickly here about the religious background of the Gospels, the major groups. You do need to be aware of this. Three major religious groups, the Pharisees, the Sadducees, and the Essenes. Pharisees, Sadducees, and Essenes. And then there are two groups I would call political, who are mentioned in passing, the Zealots and the Herodians. The Pharisees are mentioned more often than any other group. That comes from the Hebrew word parash, meaning to separate. They were the separated ones. The parashim, as it would have been called in Hebrew, comes across as Pharisees in Greek, parashim, to separate. They were the separated ones because they viewed themselves as separating from the evil people around them. I'm going to skip over this part. Some notable Pharisees of the Bible. I should mention this because this is important. We tend to paint all of the Pharisees with the same brush as being a bunch of self-righteous hypocrites. That is not necessarily the case. They were religiously zealous, which is right and good, but they were not all hypocrites and spiritually blind. There were a number of them who were genuinely dedicated to obeying God and living as best they could to obey the law. For instance, some of the positive examples of Pharisees in the Bible are Nicodemus, who comes to Jesus by night. There in the Gospel of John, there is also Joseph of Arimathea, who after Jesus is crucified, comes and asks for Jesus' body so he can give it a decent burial. These men are both Pharisees. Who's the most notable Pharisee of the Bible? Paul, the Apostle Paul. Notice this in Acts 23 and verse 6. When Paul perceived, he sets the Pharisees and the Sadducees against one another. When Paul perceived that one part were Sadducees and the other Pharisees, he said, "Men and brethren, I am a Pharisee. Not I was a Pharisee, but I am a Pharisee, the son of a Pharisee," and so on. So he viewed that Pharisaic heritage as something to be proud of. Because again, a lot of them were genuine, sincere, period. And incidentally, I mentioned the black-robed Orthodox Jews that you'll see in Israel today, like this gentleman here and here. They are essentially a modern-day continuation of the Pharisees there to this day. The Sadducees, another group that's mentioned a lot, that comes from Zadok, the priest Zadok. Zadokies, as they were originally referred to, became Sadducees. Zadokies, Sadducees. You can see the linguistic correlation there. They were very oriented toward the priesthood. A lot of the priests were Sadducees. A lot of the Sanhedrin, the Jewish religious council, were Sadducees. They believed only in the Torah, the five books of Moses. They did not accept the other Old Testament books as being inspired. They also denied the angelic world and the spirit world and Satan and so on. They basically did not believe in an afterlife. So they thought whatever you can get in this life, whoever dies with the most toys wins. So they tended to associate with the wealthy and didn't see anything wrong with becoming rich off the services at the temple there. They pretty much died out with the destruction of the temple in 70 AD. That's why you don't see or hear anything about Sadducees to this day. The last group I'll mention here just very briefly in closing was the Essenes. These are the people associated with the Dead Sea Scrolls. Here's a photo of kind of scroll I was talking about earlier, made out of parchment, pieces of animal skin about this big, sewn together to give us, this is the form the original books of the Bible would have been in, apart from some of Paul's letters that are apparently written on pieces of papyrus. So let's see. Another group, I mentioned the Zealots. I'll just mention one of the 12 apostles was Shimon the Zealot. The Zealots were a group who despised the Romans. They were the super patriots of their day. They wanted to overthrow the Romans and reestablish a Jewish kingdom there. So you see this thread throughout the Gospels of Lord, will you come at this time and establish the kingdom? And people who want to take Jesus by force and make him a king. This is the zealot thinking. They want to throw out the Romans and become independent of Roman rule. And what's really curious about this is they were also called dagger men because it was common for them to hide a dagger inside their robes and to stab a Roman or a Roman collaborator. And what I find interesting about this is among Jesus' disciples, you have Simon the Zealot and you have Matthew, the Roman tax collector. And the zealots wanted to do what? With the tax collectors. They wanted to kill them. So there had to be some very interesting dynamics among those two sitting around the campfire at night. So I will leave you with that and look forward to seeing you tomorrow morning.